Hi, today's April 1st, 2017. This is Mobile News Podcast number 200. And we have a special return guest, Frank McPherson, who is here way back when. And we'll go through that in a minute. But first, I want to say, as far as I know, we are not going to do any April Fool's stuff because A, you're probably not going to hear this on April Fool's Day anyway. And B, I really hate that. So I'm glad April Fool's Day is on Saturday this year so I can ignore all tech news and enjoy myself. But at any rate, welcome, Frank.
Good afternoon. Good morning for you.
Yep. And John, welcome back from your super.
Thank you very much. Yeah, after my couple of weeks off, in which time you did a mini mobile views and did a full mobile views and apparently had many mobile views. I was just not around for you to speak about those views.
You were not part of the mobile view.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But in any case,
I was very, very stationary for that time.
So I wanted to note that episode 200, one of the many reasons we invited Frank back, he was here for episode number 2 way back in November 28, 2008, when it was still called Mobile Apps Today podcast. I talked about Frank's T-Mobile G1 experiences. So 2008 was when the first Android phone came out, and that was our topic for podcast number 2. John joined us in podcast number 69 on December 22nd, 2013, so it's been like 3.5 years now. Three and a half years almost. And we talked about our move from Windows Mobile / Windows Phone to other mobile platforms. Did we ever go back? No.
No. No, we did not. I don't completely rule it out. If there was an actual version of Windows 10 that ran on a mobile platform, I would not rule out going back. But it would have to be full Windows 10. And have one device that I could plug into a docking station, use everything I needed to on it, and then unplug. And even then, I don't think it would be my primary phone. I think I'd still have an iPhone as well.
And I don't know about Frank, but I've said this before. If I had full Windows 10, not Windows 10 Mobile, Windows Mobile 10, what? No mobile, just Windows 10, like is on my Surface Pro 4 today, running on an 8-inch device, which had either real live cell phone capability for voice or some kind of built-in data plan, you know, data-only plan with Skype out, so I could actually do phone calls on it. I'd buy that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and a Bluetooth headset, and I'd be all set. But that's not going to happen, so I'm not going to worry about it. And we did talk about your credit card security stuff, Coin and Loop. Are they all gone?
Loop got bought up by Samsung, so it's now actually Samsung Pay.
Okay.
Coin went out of business mostly because they got eclipsed by the hype, I think, from a competitor called Plastic, and Coin Coin didn't work all that well either. It was a pretty flawed implementation once you got it. Plastic is still saying they're going to ship any day now, and I actually have a pre-order in for them. They actually did a thing about a year ago now where if you sent in your coin, you would get a discount on Plastic.
So now, how long have they been saying this?
About a year now. Okay. So it's right around the corner, Todd. It's going to happen. Okay. But I think they're kind of chasing a moving target, and that's sort of the problem.
Yeah.
Every couple of months, it's, oh, here's this new thing we're adding in immediately to our production because we now need it. So it'll be interesting to see what eventually ends up with that. But,
That's
what happened to those things.
To tie Frank's first appearance way back in November 2008, talking about his first Android mobile phone. And I should note, I had bought the same one, the T-Mobile G1, which was the first Android phone anywhere, I think. But I returned mine because of the battery life. Frank being more persistent and, I don't know what the word is, but more committed to technology than I am, perhaps. I think he bought a big honking battery pack for it that was like 52 pounds that he had to wear on his back to power his phone for the day.
Okay, I think you're exaggerating just a tad, but yes, it was a large battery extension for the back of it. But yeah, I went all in and have been very committed to Android and to the Google mobile vision since I first heard about it. In an interesting tie to that, you know, the launch of that to current events, Andy Rubin was the person behind that original G1. It actually started a company called Danger and a product called the Hip hop or hip hop, right. That was kind of the precursor to the G1. And then Andrew went, Danger ended up getting bought up by Microsoft.
Yep.
And then Andy went on to Google and became the founder or father, if you will, of Android. And he's since left Google and is actually in a company, a startup called Essential. Hmm. And the rumor, the tease that was this week on Twitter is a picture of a phone, a new phone, that looks like it has no bezel whatsoever. The tease came out just prior to Samsung's announcement, and then was somewhat reinforced by Eric Schmidt, who's the chairman of Google. So the interesting thing will be to see what that phone looks like. Boy Genius report suggests, you know, it's going to be a high-end phone. There was kind of a question whether it was going to use Android or not, but it would, one would think with Eric mentioning it, and he specifically says, phenomenal new choices for Android users coming very soon, with a link to Andy's tweet, and so that would suggest it is running Android. So it'll be interesting what new things Andy has done, unless he's decided to really just try to work on a premium phone. And what, if any, relationship he'll that Essential in him will have with Google?
Right, and I just want to note that out of the two deals, Microsoft buying Danger and Google hiring Andy Rubin, I think Google got the better end of that deal.
yeah. Particularly after the kerfuffle that happened shortly after the acquisition, where the service went down. Hard, right?
Yeah.
They had a major outage because of the transition to Microsoft's data center or their network or whatever. And so it became very quickly a black eye for them.
Yeah. And they not only went down, but they lost all the customer data because the phone, what was it called? The hip hop, whatever it was called, the Danger's phone did not actually store data locally, if I recall correctly. Everything was in the cloud. It was a real early cloud-only service, and basically when the cloud died, literally, and they lost their backups, they had like nothing.
That was the Danger hip top, and it was also rebranded by T-Mobile as the Sidekick.
Okay, I could say
that phone really helped T-Mobile a lot.
Until it crashed. And I think T-Mobile, to their credit, actually had a way to kind of recover some or all of the data if you don't turn your phone off. So people had to keep their phones continuously charged, which isn't that hard, I guess, for days until the service was stored and then somehow backed it up to back to the cloud. And I don't know. I didn't have that phone, but I remember it seemed very painful to me. But anyway, I want moving on just slightly. So MobileViews 100 was October 26, 2014, so about 2.5 years ago. And Frank was with us then, and we talked about, John and I talked about taking the iPhone 6 Plus on the road since we both had trips that previous weekend. Problems with Windows 10 technical preview, which have since been solved for years now. And something called currency. Oh, that was another one of John's... payment things, I think.
Yeah, Currency was, it still is, the third-party payment platform that basically had a bunch of exclusivity dealers with major retailers, exclusivity deals with major retailers. That, remember when Apple Pay came out, this was Walmart and a number of others that were on board with Currency.
It was really a dumb way to do it, too, as I recall.
It was. It was like a two-step QR code-based sort of thing. Walmart actually sort of ripped it off with Walmart Pay, which is their QR-based payment system. Currency let all of their exclusivity deals lapse, and slowly people have started migrating to Apple Pay and Android Pay. And really, it was so obvious then, and it's just so obvious today, that if you're going to build a point-of-sale terminal and you're going to accept contactless payments, there's no earthly reason why you wouldn't want to accept every contactless payment on the planet. I think Currency is probably near dead in its grave, if not officially.
I've not heard anything of it or whatever it became.
So John, you seem to have been really eager on this type of currency-less payment systems. Do you use Apple Pay much?
I do. In fact, I was using it daily at my local coffee shop until they got to know me so well they just opened a tab. So that might tell you a little bit about how much coffee I drink. But so I don't use Apple Pay there anymore because I don't actually pay it. You know, I just throw them some money every so often to settle up. But
that's funny.
I do use it every time I'm at a place that I can easily do it. Some retailers are still struggling. In fact, the place I had lunch today, they keep their POS terminal behind the counter. So if you want to do Apple Pay, you kind of have to reach over, and it's kind of awkward. They'll do it if you say I'd like to use Apple Pay, but it just sort of more hassle than it's worth. But yeah, when I go to McDonald's one or two times a year I go, I always pay with Apple Pay.
How about you, Frank? You use Google Pay, whatever it's called these days?
Yeah, I haven't been using it much, and the reason why is I've had issues with it in my card provider, Citibank. Basically, what happened to me about a year ago is in a matter of about 3 or 4 months, I had some fraudulent activity with my credit card. Yeah. It caused me to switch cards, and after two times in a row, Citibank, each time that happens, kind of immediately tries to lock down all these electronic payment things.
Right.
It did something in their system that said, you know what, we're not going to seem to let this guy add a new third card to Android Pay. So last I checked, actually in February, tried to get it working again. The person at Citibank was saying, well, we're in the process of getting some system changes, so come back in March. And see, you know, hopefully we'll have a better access and can make this change for you. And I haven't gotten around to get back with them.
Yeah, yeah.
I do miss it. You know, the one place I used it is when I did go into the office for work. The vending machines, all the vending machines are configured for Apple Pay and Android Pay.
Mm-hmm.
And so it became really convenient to just, you know, to not have to change and put the phone up there and make those payments. And that was the one experience that was really handy because you didn't have this human being at a cash register fumbling around with that whole process, which is still awkward because not enough people do the contactless payment there. So it's not something they do very often.
Yeah. So
the
only place that's really transparent is probably Starbucks.
Yeah, you point out the vending machines. I've also noticed it is now showing up on air dispensing machines at gas stations.
Really?
A couple of them I've been to, have Apple Pay and Android Pay. So that's kind of I think vending is a huge market that we didn't think too much about. But if I think about the reasons I don't go to vending machines that often, it's because I don't have cash.
Don't have coins.
I don't have coins, and for some of the places I go, they don't even accept credit cards. So if they had a credit card reader with NFC, it would be a huge boon to, the vending machine.
You know, I was just thinking, I have both an Android phone and an iPhone. I don't use contactless payment on either one, except for Starbucks, and not through Apple Pay. It's just literally the Starbucks app, you know, with the QR code. But I was just thinking the one place I would use it were it available would be parking meters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would be an excellent way to pay. You don't have to fumble around for, like you said, cash or coins or credit card or anything. Just tap it and pay. That'd be awesome. So there you go, meter people. That's the market that I would actually pay money for. anyway, so back in 100, we again discuss, 98. Podcast later, we discuss Frank's still going strong, still, committed focus on Google products. And I think you had a Chromebook back then, didn't you, Frank? Oh, did we lose Frank?
We lost Frank.
Okay, so we have a little technical difficulty. Let me pause. Okay, and we're back. Apparently, Comcast has decided to die in parts of Michigan. And we got Frank McPherson back with us. And so we're continuing on with our remembrances of the last 200 or so Mobile Views podcasts over the last almost 9 years. Is that right?
Yeah, and I will point out we did our due diligence while Frank was gone. We searched Twitter to see if there was a earthquake or something in Michigan, so that we, you know, if there was a problem, we would know about it.
Yeah.
Not that we could do anything about it, but you know, we could.
Well, but the early warning rabbit obviously failed to warn us of this issue, so her powers don't go across the continent.
He only works for one of the three of us. The other two are, you know, just out of luck.
Quite frankly, you know, he's 10.5 years old now, so I think his hearing is actually going. He's also got cataracts in both eyes, but he can see out of one, kinda. So I have to stay on his good side when.
Literally and metaphorically.
Literally, because he will run into me if I'm on the wrong side. Oh, and I just got, I don't know if you heard a ding on there, but just got a text message from somebody. Oh, my wife. She just landed in San Francisco. Okay, great. We're talking about our memories of a couple hundred podcasts, and back in episode 100 with Frank, we were again talking about, I know what I was asking Frank before his ISP dropped him. Did you have a Chromebook back then in 2014, Frank?
2014, I probably did. That's only a couple, you know, 3 years ago. Yeah.
And are you still using a Chromebook?
Yeah. It's you know, I'm not using it every day, probably because the Surface 3 has become something I use a lot. But still like it, and I know you got the Samsung Plus, the recent one, and I've been keeping my eye on your experience with that. I'm contemplating whether to get that or the Pro when it becomes available.
Yeah, which is this month, actually. The Pro comes out in a couple, 2 weeks or so. I should note that my friend, Paul Lawler, this is what happens when you get old, you start forgetting your good friends. My friend Paul Lawler, who was on the podcast 199 with me, talking about our mutual Samsung Chromebook Pro Plus experiences, decided to return his, by the way. And he went high-end. He bought a Surface Book to replace it. So it's not for everybody, you know. It wasn't for Paul. It's working out well for me, as I mentioned to Paul when he's there. I think we only had it a week or so. And I think I may have mentioned it to John, is I rarely boot up my MacBook or Dell laptop anymore. I'm usually just using the Samsung Chromebook Plus around the house. You know, with the exception of doing things like recording a podcast over Skype, which I don't think you can do, or processing the audio files for that matter, there's not a lot it doesn't do. It does the 90% of things that I do, you know, 90% at a time. So it's working out fine for me. Back then, John also bought a iPad Air 2. An iPad Mini 3. I was still on the original iPad 2 and iPad Mini, the original iPad Mini.
And I still use both of those devices regularly.
Right.
So they're still around. One of the other things that we talked about on that podcast, and this came up today at lunch. I was out with my wife, and I looked over at the table across from me, and there was a woman that I knew who isn't a geek really of any kind, but she had an Apple Watch on, and we talked about how the Pebble smartwatch was, you know, still new versions of Pebble were coming out. Now Pebble obviously is gone.
Bought by Fitbit, right?
Yeah, bought by Fitbit. Yep. But it's interesting how I think smartwatches, while they aren't taking off as fast as many had maybe optimistically predicted in 2014, they didn't go away like many others predicted in 2014. and when you start seeing, living in a small town of 15,000 people, when I see non-tech people wearing a smartwatch, makes me think that these might be, you know, here at least for a little while longer.
You don't think it's just the 1% of your 15,000 residents?
I think I've seen more than 1% at this point.
Okay. I should note that Android Wear 2.0 just came out, but my watch is too old to take advantage of it, so I have no idea, you know, how much better that experience is. And, you know, fairly large companies like Motorola have decided not to pursue the Android Wear watches anymore, or at least for the foreseeable future. So at least on the Android side of things, it's looking a little grim, I think.
Yeah, it seems though that Apple has decided to keep going with it, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Apple.
I would say, though, Todd, to your point about Android Wear, the interesting thing about that, though, is the number of companies, and particularly brand name guys, the Tag Heuers and the Tommy Hilfers and all that, Fossil, are all coming out with Android Wear phones. I think there's a, is it Movado that's the really high-end
Well, isn't black Tug phone? Tug Heuer's not actually...
They announced...
Tug Heuer is not exactly level. I mean, you know, low-end consumer phone. It's not a Timex.
Well, I guess it's interesting that some of these brand name, traditional brand name watchmakers are actually coming out with Android Wear 2 devices.
Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting. I hope they're upgradable because I'd hate to buy a $4,000 watch and, you know, you're stuck at Android Wear 2.1 or something 2 years from now.
My Huawei watch is supposed to be upgraded, and it still has not been upgraded, and they haven't said when they're going to release it. Yeah, so I am anxiously waiting.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say though, you know, the big difference between most of the consumer technology that we buy and use today had really nothing comparable to it, you know, unless you consider a pad of paper comparable to an iPad or tablet. But watches have a long, long history, especially the high-end stuff, you know, by the, like you said, Frank, the big name brands, where you're paying thousands of dollars for a watch. And, you know, this is something you hand down to your kids or, you know, whatever. And, you know, a decade later, you're still pretty happy to wear a really nice watch that you bought 10, 12, 20 years ago. But I don't think that's the case for, you know, these wearable type watches. At least I don't think so. I don't know. We'll have to see, you know, in a couple of years if people are still wearing the Tag Heuer or whatever watch they bought for a couple thousand dollars back in 2017. I suspect not, personally. But we'll see. We'll see. I'll be happy to be wrong. Let's see. We were also talking about Windows 10 technical preview on my Dell Venue 8 Pro, and it had completely glitched out on me. And in fact, it took me about a couple of weeks to get it back to the point where I could reboot on it. I wasn't working on it every day. Every couple of days, I'd take a look at it, try something new, and finally got it to reboot and reinstall. We talked about Microsoft Garage, which is kind of their prosumer research group. They had just started dabbling in Android apps. So, you know, although we think of Microsoft's Android apps as being kind of their premier mobile entries these days, they're just starting on it when we talked about it in Podcast 100. And again, we revisited CurrentC, and John was ranting about CVS and Rite Aid shutting down support for Apple Pay to adopt. So does CVS and Rite Aid now take Apple Pay, by the way?
That's a good question. I haven't been to one in a while, so.
Yeah.
Rite Aid does.
Okay.
They'll take Apple and Android Pay. I know that for sure. I've been in recently, but I'm not sure about CVS.
Okay. We have a CVS here, but I can't remember what they take. And getting back to John's comment about Pebble Watches, which are now gone, I had noted that I saw both the Pebble Watch and a Samsung Gear at Sam's Club, you know, the other center of technology besides Costco. So that's where we're for, you know, podcast 269 and 100 with Frank and or John or both of them. So that brings us to today. So this week... iOS 10.3 was released for the iPhone and iPad. I've only upgraded one device because I'm really not comfortable with the new file system that comes out with 10.3. So, John, did you upgrade everything?
I upgraded just my iPhone. I haven't upgraded anything else.
Yeah, I just upgraded my iPad Mini 4, I think. I don't think this affects you or Frank, but a number of states in the U.S. are now going to be charged sales tax, or in Hawaii's case, something we call excise tax, which is worse than sales tax, by Amazon. So we were able to buy from Amazon without being forced to pay sales tax, but starting today, April 1st, not an April Fool's joke, those of us in Hawaii and a couple other states that were kind of free of this requirement now have to start paying whatever percentage of tax your state requires. So hopefully that helps with the various states' revenues, but we'll have to wait and see. John, Frank, do you guys have to already pay sales tax on Amazon? Or do you have sales tax in your states?
We have sales tax. We do have sales tax in Michigan. I think we've been amongst some of the last holdouts for the online sales, but I do think that we soon will have our sales tax collected by Amazon.
Okay.
Yeah, and Mississippi is basically in the same boat, state sales tax, but I think last fall Amazon started collecting here. So oh, okay. we've got kind of a gradual entry into it.
So you're already paying for that. So at any rate, maybe it was silly, but I ordered a couple of things, which like last week, which still haven't shipped. Thanks, Amazon. including an Anchor. I think it's an Anchor. Is it an Anchor? I think I bought an Anchor. You know, one of those. Yeah, it's a USB 40-watt hubs with five USB ports. Well, one of the ports is USB-C. So I'm going to see if I can use that to as an alternate power supply for my Chromebook Plus if my official Samsung power brick dies on me for some reason. And I have had that happen, by the way. So I mean, not Samsung, but other power bricks. So we'll see how that goes. Not big, huge news, unless you're, a developer. But I found it interesting is that Google announced that they're moving their open source projects over to a new URL called opensource.google.com. Now we have a bunch of stuff that Frank contributed this week, and you know I haven't really followed the Samsung S8 announcement, Frank. So, what's the big deal about it? Doesn't catch fire, yes. I assume.
Yeah, well, so Samsung had their big event earlier this week in which they announced the new generation of the S line, the Samsung S8, and an S8 Plus. So the S8 will have a 5.8-inch screen, and the Plus model will have a 6.2-inch screen. Huh. It's a taller device. The real significant thing about the screen, it's an OLED screen, but they've taken the technology of the Edge model, and they've applied it to the S8. So basically, it's a bezel-less view of the screen from side to side, and not much, if any, bezel at all to the top and bottom. So the screen, while it's larger, the physical footprint of the device is, I think, pretty much within the specs of the previous generations. Mm. Obviously, the 6.2 model is larger. Mm. So the screen is definitely a big difference. It's a big visual difference for them. The other big change here for Samsung, and they've been one of the last holdouts of having a physical button on the front of the device.
I didn't know that.
And that button is now gone. Yeah. They've taken, as I understand it, and put the button somehow underneath the screen at the bottom. So it's a pressure sensitive type of thing. So you basically press the bottom of the screen to do the kind of home screen function that they've had traditionally.
It has a physical button, you just can't see it.
Right, but the screen is overlaid on top of it, so you're still getting the extra display space.
Okay.
And the navigation buttons are all software. So essentially, from the front of the device, there's no buttons at all that you can see.
Hmm. Interesting, because, you know, the Nexus line, or I should say Nexus lines, because they're different manufacturers, they haven't had a physical button in a while now.
So Samsung has been one of the holdouts in that, I think, at least with the S line. So, yeah. And as you noted, with the issues that they had with the Note 7 and the battery and that bursting into flames, this announcement was really important for Samsung. They need this model of phone to be really, you know, something that's going to help people forget about their prior problems. And so I think what I see here from the device, it certainly, you know, has the possibility of doing just that. It certainly looks new, innovative, and so forth. The question is going to be, is the battery life? It has a higher, a larger screen. It's bright. The battery, I think the the regular model is a 3,000 milliamp size battery, and I think the plus model is closer to 3,500, which seem like large batteries, but when you factor in the larger screen and the brightness of that screen, which are a big power draw, it'll be interesting to see whether the battery life is sufficient.
Does it have an SD card slot of some kind, or is it like...
It does.
It does. Oh, that's a plus.
It does. Yeah. It's got, and it's one of the, I think it's the first to implement Bluetooth 5.0. Hmm. And it's using a newer generation of the Qualcomm processor. I think I want to say an 825 or 835, but it's the latest and greatest of the Qualcomm processors that's been in all these devices. So it's certainly a leading edge, leading technology wise. Phone. Yeah.
But unless Samsung did something smart with their SD card, and they haven't done anything smart with the SD card in the Samsung Chromebook Plus, by the way. Like most Android devices, the SD card is just there for media. You can install some apps on it, I guess, but not all. Hardly any of the Google apps, which are gigantic, will install on an SD card for whatever reason.
Well, that's supposed to be changed in Android 7 in Nougat, where they were Android itself was providing better integration of SD cards so that it provides a more integrated and complete file system for the device. Oh, so, and I believe this device does have Nougat on it. So. That should help with there. But obviously, I don't know how many people actually use the card slots, but certainly from a perception standpoint, it gives the perception that it's, you can upgrade it or add more storage to it for those people who wish to do so.
And this is an Android exactly, but it's Chrome OS, but on Samsung Chromebook Plus, I put a 64 gigabyte, a mini SD, or micro SD, whatever the heck it is, XC card in it. But it's of limited value because I can manually place things on there, but I cannot, for example, download movies or TV shows from Google Play that I've purchased to the external SD card. It goes into main RAM. There's like no option I can see that lets me. But anyway, and that would be my main use for having the extra.
My understanding is that the Android in those Samsung models is not Nougat. It's 6.0.
Wow.
So it's old. I think that's one of the things that was still coming. Yeah, is my recollection.
So thank you, Android
Fragmentation. That may come with the Pro model.
Yeah. So we got to thank Android Fragmentation once again.
Well, it's the vendors, right? I mean, I don't know why the vendors kind of lag behind in some of this stuff. I mean, it's certainly not Google that's causing that.
Yeah. Well, I think it is, to me, anyway, because Google allowed so much freedom to the vendors, although they tried to pull it back a while back. Remember all the really awful user interface add-ons that were the skins that were on Android for a while that everybody hated and caused all kinds of problems. That was one of the things that caused initial fragmentation. But at any rate, let's see, did we lose Frank again? I think he's frozen. Frank, can you hear us? We may have lost Frank again. Let me pause this. And we're back, I think. Yep, we're back with Frank again. Still having technical difficulties in Michigan, but we are, ISPs. Speaking of ISPs, Frank added something else to our show note that I think he wanted to talk about was something about the recent Senate vote.
So there's been, our fine representatives in Washington, D.C. Have, passed legislation, at least through this.
Oh, I think we lost Frank again. I'm going to pause once more. Anyway, we're back from another technical glitch. But in any case, if Frank was mentioning that the Senate voted to repeal an FCC policy that was voted on last year when Tom Wheeler was still chair of the FCC, but has not been put into motion, and that was the SEC policy to prevent ISPs from selling browser history data to third parties. And now the Senate says that can be done. And the president is expected to sign it, although he hasn't yet. But the thing to remember, I think anyway, is, no matter which way you feel about this, whether pro or con, and it seems to be con for many people, both the left and right on the political spectrum, this law has actually not been enacted, or was not a law. The policy was not enacted. So it's not that anything's going to change. It's they've been able to do it all this time. It's just that it was going to be enacted, I think, sometime this month, or going to force be enforced this month. So they've been whatever they've been doing, they've been doing for like forever, and they're just still going to do it. So, you know, it's from
well, the interesting thing is Comcast, who of course is one of the largest ones out there, yep. and has come out and said that they will not sell customer data. I would imagine the AT&Ts and a lot of all the ISPs will probably try to come out and say the same thing. It's going to be a question of whether consumers trust them and believe them. You know, it is a question of how would we know if they don't? Right. You know, considering how much spam most people get in the filters that we have these days, and the telemarketing calls we get these days, I don't know. Part of me feels like it's not going to get any worse than it actually is, or how much more worse can it be? So, you know, it's a bit of, I think there's a bit of theatrics going on, with Comcast. I think if there is an ISP, if you have competition in your area, I would imagine that, you know, one ISP will try to maybe if sell itself as the, you know, more concerned about mm-hmm. your privacy. Mm-hmm. But this is credence. There's always been this movement across the internet for the last year or so about HTTPS everywhere.
Okay. A little bit of glitch in Frank's thing, but I'll continue on since I know what Frank's saying. I think he's going to return in a few seconds. This is talking about HTTPS, which, you know, basically turn on SSL encryption. For, you know, Google now requires you have HTTPS turned on if you want to be listed on their search engines, I believe. In fact, I had to go do so on my ISP. And recently, I think, you know, if you've been our fives or listeners, you'll know that I dumped one of my web hosting services of many years. I think Frank's back on. And I moved it to medium.com, which, you know, is all the certificates and stuff. I'm going to pause quick. Okay, Frank's back. Anyway, we're talking about HTTPS and how it's required in a lot of places now. And how I moved, I dumped one of my ISPs actually because it was just going to be a hassle to turn on HTTPS. Moved to Medium, which has it on by default. And in Frank's notes, I see, you know, now that we've got this whole privacy thing going, I should note, I think Verizon's probably going to turn on their super cookies again. So that'll be interesting if that happens. Frank asks, you know, should we use a VPN? John, I know you have a VPN service you like.
Yeah, I've been using private internet access for probably 2-3 years now. So that's what I use. They were one of the first ones to basically say, not only do we not sell your data, we don't even log what you do. So, of course, this is always what you believe in the company. And, you know, when Frank brought up, do we trust companies when they say that they're not doing this? I think it's more so that our definition and their definition would differ. Our definition might be if you create an advertiser profile of me living at 123 Any Street and you sell that, even if you don't sell my name, you're still giving enough information to identify me and get target advertising. Whereas the ISPs will go, no, that's perfectly anonymous because your name wasn't attached to it. So I think we would be more comfortable with if an ISP were selling, here's the top search terms that we see coming through, or here's the top content that people are watching right now. But that sort of thing, I think, is what we think of as anonymous enough, and I think the ISPs just think if I don't say your name, that's good enough.
Yeah. What about you, Frank? Are you using a VPN service?
No, I'm not, and I've been really kind of wondering whether it's something I want to play around with and start to incorporate. Like I mentioned, you know, part of the challenge is just the complexity with it, which is why I think it's interesting that you got Opera, who has it integrated with the browser.
Yeah.
And that seems to be a much easier approach for most people.
Right. Yeah, if all you need to do is secure web browsing using a VPN, the Opera browser is an interesting option. However, one thing to note is the Chinese company recently bought it. So, you know, depends how much you trust that new owner in a potentially unfriendly country. So,
but I wonder whether Google or Microsoft would at all consider doing the same thing with them. Now, I could see Google having a problem with that because that probably impedes on a big source of revenue for them because advertising and getting data is probably 80% of their business model.
Yep, yep. Don't know. I don't see that as a Google kind of thing. Microsoft, I don't know. You know, although I just looked up Google VPN, I see Tech Republic had an old article 2 years ago, March 2015, saying Google's working on a VPN service, but I guess that never happened.
Right.
Yeah.
Though the interesting thing with Android that's tied to connecting to wireless networks where, you know, it will create a secure connection, which I take it to mean it's got to be very similar to a VPN type of connection. So, you know, that would suggest that built into Android is at least the ability to create a tunnel from the device into something on Google's side. Now, if they're the other side of the tunnel and then they get everything out of the tunnel and out to the rest of the internet, that would still probably provide them with the opportunity to gather whatever they normally would gather.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing to consider is, I'm just kind of looking up some stuff. This is from May 2016 on ZDNet, where there's an article talking about this service called Hotspot Shield by a company called Anchor Free. Now, interestingly enough, for folks who choose to do so, you can go back to MobiView's podcast number 23, and I speak with the then, I don't know if he's still there, but the then CEO and co-founder of Anchor, of Hotspot Shield, David Gordansky. So, you know, and I felt after speaking with him, I felt pretty comfortable about using their service. I played with it for a while. I don't currently use it, but it's something I might revisit now. So, anyway, I'll put something in the show notes. It's called Hotspot Shield VPN from Anchor Free, and it is free. I think they did inject ads into the browser, though. That's kind of one thing to remember. But again, you can go back to Mobi's podcast number 23 and hear what he had to say back in, let's see, 2009 when I spoke with David. So there's something to consider, I guess.
So I think the bottom line summary to this, as you noted earlier, the legislation had not been implemented that would have prevented ISPs from selling of data or doing anything with the information about its customers.
Right.
So effectively, there's no change in the law. But what's happening now, basically, at least for the time being, says we can't count on the government in trying to do something that's going to protect us. So if it's a concern for us, then we as consumers are going to have to do something for ourselves,
right,
whether it's implementing a VPN or a different browser or so, those types of techniques.
Right. So mm-hmm. And I think, you know, for folks like the three of us, especially basically geeks, this kind of stuff is an error to, you know, reroute around. Right. But the problem is for the vast majority of non-technical people who don't even know what a VPN is. You know, those are the people that, I don't know, could be taken advantage of, you know, by things like super cookies and ad injections and all kinds of other, you know, stuff that isn't malware but is potentially annoying or violating your privacy or doing things you're unaware of that you might not want. You know, for example, if you go to a website and you click on an ad for that website, you know, that's a good thing, right? So the website gets some money from the advertiser, and the advertiser gets a click from you, and you might buy something, and that's fine. You've got a, you know, a three-way transaction, makes sense. But if an ISP is now injecting ads into your, you know, a site that you like and that, you know, you see ads on, and you click on that ad, you're no longer helping that website, because you're clicking on an ad injected by the ISP and not by, you know, not chosen by the website owner to be presented on his or her site. So, you know, that's one thing I kind of worry about, that the money is going to the wrong place if they start doing things like ad panel injection. But anywho, my two cents.
Yeah.
Thoughts, John?
Again, HTTPS solves most of these problems for most people. You can't do ad injection. You can't do some of the things that I've seen ISPs do that are dubious in nature in terms of DNS poisoning and things like that. So I like the idea of HTTPS, but I also think that if you are traveling, if you are in a hotel or you're in somewhere where you're not quite sure how the Wi-Fi is set up, it's a good idea to have a VPN service.
Yeah.
And with things like the with my internet provider that I use or my service that I use and a number of others, you can now just basically turn it on your phone and never bother with turning it off. It'll recreate the connection if it goes down. It'll keep you kind of connected as often as you need to. So really, turn it on, and then unless you have an issue or something, you might have to toggle it off on here and there, but you'll probably be fine. It's a lot easier than it was 2 years ago to have one of these VPNs.
Yeah, and by the way, that's a good point. If you are not in your home and not in your office, you know, like you're at a coffee shop or a restaurant or airport, you really do want to use a VPN if you have one and not be, you know, exposed to whatever is out there. You know, one place where HTTPS may not, or SSL in general, may not be of any good is in your workplace, by the way. If your enterprise is basically doing a man-in-the-middle interception of encrypted SSL traffic, there, you know, you're wide open. At least once it gets past their firewall. So now, if there's something going on in the network inside the intranet, so to speak, inside of the corporate network that is bad, you know, like somebody's exploited it, you will be exposed even if you have SSL turned on. So just something to consider. Yeah.
Very true.
Yeah. Okay. And the last item. I'm trying to think if I have any items I wanted to mention. That on Frank's list, I guess. If Frank, it looks like you bought a new keyboard or something.
Well, yeah. So Logitech announced a couple weeks ago the Performance MK850, which is a full-size keyboard and mouse bundle. Mm-hmm. And the couple of things unique about it are the main thing, I guess, which is why I bought it, is its ability to connect to three different devices. So, and Logitech said this before, where they specifically had a keyboard targeted towards tablets and phones and, of course, desktops. But that was a kind of a smaller keyboard. It was more like a notebook size. This is an actual full-size keyboard with a numeric keypad and all the function keys and everything that you'd like. It's actually got an ergonomic design. It's a pretty nice keyboard. And it connects both. It comes both with a USB dongle and support for Bluetooth. So that basically for a device that, you know, Bluetooth doesn't work well, you can use the dongle for, and then the others you can use Bluetooth. And my reason for this is I have, you know, I work from home most often, so I have a work provided computer, and then I have a my personal devices. I have a Surface 3, which is what I would use, say, as my Windows 10 desktop at my specific workspace. And then I have a Mint box, which runs Linux Mint. And so those three different devices are what I use the most. And I was actually having to swap physical keyboards between them, or move the dongle around or that type of thing. And I was hoping that this would be something that would make that whole process a little bit neater. Unfortunately, there was an incompatibility issue with the Bluetooth with my work computer. And so it was actually causing a blue screen of death. That was frustrating. So I found out on Friday that my Bluetooth drivers for Windows 10 was out of date. So I upgraded those. And so I'll need to tell next week whether that actually solves the problem. But it's once again a reminder that, you know, Bluetooth, something that's been around for seemingly forever, continues to be problematic and doesn't just work.
Yeah.
As most would come to expect.
As our mutual friend Ed Hansberry would say, well, he would say things we probably can't repeat on the air, but he would have a few choice words about Bluetooth. And I should say, as much as I like my Samsung Chromebook Plus, it still cannot pair with an Amazon Echo. And I confirm that this is a problem with both Paul Lawler, who was on the podcast a while back, and Kevin Toefel. So, you know, three of us have the same problem with Samsung Chromebook Plus and Echo.
I will also just point out that if you are in a position like Frank's, and you are saying, you know, I just need, I want to have one keyboard, one mouse. On eBay, you can buy a USB 4-port KVM switch box for $22.
Yeah, but then you got to connect something.
Yeah, then you got to connect things. That is the only problem. But if you are really frustrated with Bluetooth, really frustrated with wireless in general, sometimes that's the only way to do it. And once it's all set up, it's usually fairly easy of a
okay,
setup.
You know,
go ahead.
I wonder why the computers or notebook computers have not come out with the wireless radio that is in these dongles just built in. And just use that for wireless keyboard and mouse and not, you know, so you would just pair it. It seems like those dongles have been around for many years, and I can't believe the radio in them is very large or draws much power. You would think they would have just been incorporated. I guess we continue to hang our hats on the integrated wireless technology for this being Bluetooth and just have not explored alternatives.
Well, not knowing how the RF dongles work, I wonder if they're paired for life, so to speak, with their accessories. What happens if a dongle or keyboard breaks? Can you just, let's say a keyboard or mouse breaks. Can you just buy a new keyboard or mouse from that same vendor and it'll automatically work with a dongle? Or are they paired somehow?
I think most of them are paired. However, Logitech, with what I bought, they champion something called the Unifying 2.4 gigahertz, is what the dongle is, which at least reads like it's supposed to support any other peripheral that supports that standard. So it looks like they've attempted to do something, but maybe they've been trying to sell it to computer manufacturers and nobody's bought into it. I don't know.
Hmm. You know, while you were talking, I grabbed my Logitech keyboard, which is the, let's see, what is it called? The K480, which I think is what you may have been talking about, Frank.
Right.
And it is, it's funny because I bought it too, and it has a little dial, like you said, that lets it pair with three different devices. But the thing is, I didn't realize how, you said it was small, but it's so huge, I don't carry it. But it's a good keyboard, so I use it at home with my tablet and phone and stuff, three different devices.
Yeah, but it's basically a notebook size keyboard, right? Absolutely. It's small compared to a full size desktop keyboard, but it's still large that you would not want to carry it around.
Yeah, and heavy. In fact, I just put it up next to my MacBook Pro keyboard, and it's the same width as my MacBook Pro keyboard. So yeah, it's a full size notebook keyboard, as you said. At any rate, so as we're coming up to the end of podcast 200, John, you got anything you want to add? Any new toys that you want to mention?
No new toys over here. Just sort of slogging through April so I can take a breath in May. The way it is in the academic world. So it was fun to kind of look back and see what we were talking about 2.5 years ago. And I'll be interested to see what we'll be talking about in 2.5 years.
Yep. And one kind of useless app that I had fun with that I want to mention in my occasional series of useless things is there is a free app called My Talking Pet for iOS, which I downloaded a while back. And what it lets you do is it lets you take a photo of an animal or anything else, I guess, that has something that looks like a mouth. And you can have the app adjust to where it thinks the mouth is, and you can talk, and it'll look like the animal is talking, synced to your whatever words you're saying. So my daughter was anxiously awaiting for things. No, actually, she wasn't anxiously waiting. I was trying to get her to send in her grad school application a while back. And since I didn't want to be that parent going, did you do it yet? Did you do it yet? I instead sent her a photo of her pet rabbit with my voice in the background saying, did you send in your application? And she did, but by the way. So anyway, My Talking Pet for iOS, it's free, it's fun.
You didn't want to be that parent that bothers their child to do something. You wanted to be that parent that bothers their child to do something in a creepy yet humorous way.
It's not creepy.
I don't know about you, but rabbits around me don't usually talk to me in English. But
you've never seen Bugs Bunny?
Around me, Bugs Bunny's never shown up at my door. So
it showed up on a screen just like Bugs Bunny does.
That's true. I guess you're right.
Anyway, I want to thank Frank McPherson for joining us for podcast number 200. Sorry that he had a whole bunch of connectivity issues, so bad ISP. But at any rate, we still had fun, and hope the tiny technical glitches in the recording. I tended to pause things on time, so you shouldn't hear too much of it. Thanks, Frank. It was great talking to you again, as usual.
Yep, you're welcome. Sorry about the issues.
Out of your control, my friend. Out of your control. No, nothing to worry about. All righty, folks. That brings 200 to an end. We will talk to you next time.